justly deserved. The knight bowed low and gracefully, but returned no answer. While the trumpets sounded, while the heralds strained their voices in proclaiming honour to the brave and glory to the victor, while ladies waved their silken kerchiefs and embroidered veils, and while all ranks joined in a clamorous shout of exultation, the marshals conducted the disinherited knight across the lists to the foot of that throne of honour which was occupied by the Lady Rowena. On the lower step of this throne, the champion was made to kneel down. Indeed, his whole action since the fight had ended seemed rather to have been upon the impulse of those around him than from his own free will, and it was observed that he tottered as they guided him the second time across the lists. Rowena, descending from her station with a graceful and dignified step, was about to place the chaplet which she held in her hand upon the helmet of the champion, when the marshals exclaimed with one voice, "It must not be thus! His head must be bare!" The knight muttered faintly a few words, which were lost in the hollow of his helmet, but their purport seemed to be a desire that his casque might not be removed. Whether from love of form or from curiosity, the marshals paid no attention to his expressions of reluctance, but unhelmed him by cutting the laces of his casque and undoing the fastening of his gorget. When the helmet was removed, the well-formed yet sunburnt features of a young man of 25 were seen, amidst a profusion of short, fair hair. His countenance was as pale as death, and marked in one or two places with streaks of blood. Rowena had no sooner beheld him than she uttered a faint shriek, but at once summoning up the energy of her disposition, and compelling herself, as it were, to proceed, while her frame yet trembled with the violence of sudden emotion, she placed upon the drooping head of the victor the splendid chaplet which was the destined reward of the day, and pronounced, in a clear and distinct tone, these words, "I bestow on thee this chaplet, Sir Knight, as the meed of valour assigned to this day's victor." Here she paused a moment, and then firmly added, "And upon brows more worthy could a wreath of chivalry never be placed." The knight stooped his head and kissed the hand of the lovely sovereign by whom his valour had been rewarded, and then, sinking yet farther forward, lay prostrate at her feet. There was a general consternation. Cedric, who had been struck mute by the sudden appearance of his banished son, now rushed forward as if to separate him from Rowena, but this had been already accomplished by the marshals of the field, who, guessing the cause of Ivanhoe's swoon, had hastened to disarm him, and found that the head of a lance had penetrated his breastplate and inflicted a wound upon his side. Chapter 13 "Heroes, approach," Atrides thus aloud, "stand forth distinguished from the circling crowd. Ye who by skill or manly force may claim your rivals to surpass and merit fame, this cow worth 20 oxen is decreed for him who farthest sends the winged reed." Iliad. The name of Ivanhoe was no sooner pronounced than it flew from mouth to mouth with all the celerity with which eagerness could convey and curiosity receive it. It was not long ere it reached the circle of the prince, whose brow darkened as he heard the news. Looking around him, however, with an air of scorn, "My lords," said he, "and especially you, Sir Prior, what think ye of the doctrine the learned tell us concerning innate attractions and antipathies? Methinks that I felt the presence of my brother's minion, even when I least guessed whom yonder suit of armour enclosed." "Front de Boeuf must prepare to restore his fief of Ivanhoe," said Brassy, who, having discharged his part honourably in the tournament, had laid his shield and helmet aside, and again mingled with the prince's retinue. "Aye," answered Waldemar Fitzurse, "this gallant is likely to reclaim the castle and manor which Richard assigned to him, and which your highness's generosity has since given to Front de Boeuf."
"Front de Boeuf,"
replied John, "is a man more willing to swallow three manors, such as Ivanhoe, than to disgorge one of them. For the rest, sirs, I hope none here will deny my rights to confer the fiefs of the crown upon the faithful followers who are around me, and ready to perform the usual military service in the room of those who have wandered to foreign countries and can neither render homage nor service when called upon." The audience were much too interested in the question not to pronounce the prince's assumed right altogether indubitable. "A generous prince, a most noble lord, who thus takes upon himself the task of rewarding his faithful followers." Such were the words which burst from the train, expectants all of them of similar grants at the expense of King Richard's followers and favourites, if indeed they had not as yet received such. Prior Aymer also assented to the general proposition, observing, however, that the blessed Jerusalem could not indeed be termed a foreign country. She was communis mater, the mother of all Christians. But he saw not, he declared, how the knight of Ivanhoe could plead any advantage from this, since he, the prior, was assured that the Crusaders under Richard had never proceeded much farther than Ascalon, which, as the world knew, was a town of the Philistines, and entitled to none of the privileges of the holy city. Waldemar, whose curiosity had led him towards the place where Ivanhoe had fallen to the ground, now returned. "The gallant," said he, "is likely to give your highness little disturbance, and to leave Front-de-Boeuf in the quiet possession of his gains. He is severely wounded."
"Whatever becomes of him," said Prince John, "he is victor of the day, and were he tenfold our enemy, or the devoted friend of our brother, which is perhaps the same, his wounds must be looked to. Our own physician shall attend him."
A stern smile curled the prince's lip as he spoke. Waldemar Fitzurse hastened to reply that Ivanhoe was already removed from the lists and in the custody of his friends.
"I was somewhat moved," he said, "to see the grief of the Queen of Love and Beauty, whose sovereignty of a day this event has changed into mourning. I am not a man to be moved by a woman's lament for her lover, but this same Lady Rowena suppressed her sorrow with such dignity of manner that it could only be discovered by her folded hands and her tearless eye, which trembled as it remained fixed on the lifeless form before her."
"Who is this Lady Rowena?" said Prince John, "of whom we have heard so much?"
"A Saxon heiress of large possessions," replied the prior Aymer, "a rose of loveliness and a jewel of wealth. The fairest among a thousand, a bundle of myrrh and a cluster of camphire."
"We shall cheer her sorrows," said Prince John, "and amend her blood by wedding her to a Norman. She seems a minor, and must therefore be at our royal disposal in marriage. How sayst thou, De Bracy? What thinkst thou of gaining fair lands and livings by wedding a Saxon, after the fashion of the followers of the Conqueror?"
"If the lands are to my liking, my lord," answered Bracy, "it will be hard to displease me with a bride, and deeply will I hold myself bound to your highness for a good deed which will fulfil all promises made in favour of your servant and vassal."
"We will not forget it," said Prince John, "and that we may instantly go to work, command our seneschal presently to order the attendance of the Lady Rowena and her company. That is, the rude churl, her guardian, and the Saxon ox whom the Black Knight struck down in the tournament upon this evening's banquet. De Bigo," he added to his seneschal, "thou wilt word this our second summons so courteously as to gratify the pride of these Saxons and make it impossible for them again to refuse. Although, by the bones of Becket, courtesy to them is casting pearls before swine."
Prince John had proceeded thus far, and was about to give the signal for retiring from the lists, when a small billet was put into his hand.
"From whence?" said Prince John, looking at the person by whom it was delivered.
"From foreign parts, my lord, but from whence I know not," replied his attendant. "A Frenchman brought it hither, who said he had ridden night and day to put it into the hands of your highness."
The prince looked narrowly at the superscription, and then at the seal, placed so as to secure the flock silk with which the billet was surrounded, and which bore the impression of three fleurs-de-lis. John then opened the billet with apparent agitation, which visibly increased when he had perused the contents, which were expressed in these words: "Take heed to yourself, for the devil is unchained." The prince turned as pale as death, looked first on the earth and then up to heaven, like a man who has received news of sentence of death having been passed upon him. Recovering from the first effects of his surprise, he took Waldemar Fitzurse and De Bracy aside and put the billet into their hands successively. "This may be a false alarm, or a forged letter," said Bracy.
"It is France's own hand and seal," replied Prince John.
"It is time, then," said Fitzurse, "to draw our party to a head, either at York or some other centrical place. A few days later, and it will be indeed too late, your highness must break short this present mummery."
"The yeomen and commons," said Bracy, "must not be dismissed discontented for lack of their share in the sports."
"The day," said Waldemar, "is not yet very far spent. Let the archers shoot a few rounds at the target, and the prize be adjudged. This will be an abundant fulfilment of the prince's promises, so far as this herd of Saxon serfs is concerned."
"I thank thee, Waldemar," said the prince. "Thou remindest me, too, that I have a debt to pay to that insolent peasant who yesterday insulted our person. Our banquet also shall go forward tonight as we proposed. Were this my last hour of power, it should be an hour sacred to revenge and to pleasure. Let new cares come with tomorrow's new day."
The sound of the trumpet soon recalled those spectators who had already begun to leave the field, and proclamation was made that Prince John, suddenly called by high and peremptory public duties, held himself obliged to discontinue the entertainments of tomorrow's festival. Nevertheless, that unwilling so many good yeomen should depart without a trial of skill, he was pleased to appoint them, before leaving the ground, presently to execute the competition of archery intended for the morrow. To the best archer a prize was to be awarded, being a bugle horn mounted with silver, and a silken baldric richly ornamented with a medallion of St. Hubert, the patron of sylvan sport. More than 30 yeomen at first presented themselves as competitors, several of whom were rangers and underkeepers in the royal forests of Needwood and Charnwood. When, however, the archers understood with whom they were to be matched, upwards of 20 withdrew themselves from the contest, unwilling to encounter the dishonour of almost certain defeat. For in these days the skill of each celebrated marksman was as well known for many miles round him as the qualities of a horse trained at Newmarket are known to those who frequent that celebrated meeting. The diminished list of competitors for sylvan fame still amounted to 8. Prince John stepped from his royal seat to view more nearly the persons of these chosen yeomen, several of whom wore the royal livery. Having satisfied his curiosity by this investigation, he looked for the object of his resentment, whom he observed standing in the same spot and with the same composed countenance which he had exhibited upon the preceding day.
"Fellow," said Prince John, "I guessed by thy insolent babble thou wert no true lover of the longbow, and I see thou darest not adventure thy skill among such merry men as stand yonder."
"Under favour, sir," replied the yeoman, "I have another reason for refraining to shoot, besides the fearing discomfiture and disgrace."
"And what is thy other reason?" said Prince John,
who, for some cause which perhaps he could not himself have explained, felt a painful curiosity respecting this individual.
"Because," replied the woodsman, "I know not if these yeomen and I are used to shoot at the same marks. And because, moreover, I know not how your grace might relish the winning of a third prize by one who has unwittingly fallen under your displeasure."
Prince John coloured as he put the question.
"What is thy name, yeoman?"
"Locksley,"
answered the yeoman.
"Then, Locksley," said Prince John, "thou shalt shoot in thy turn when these yeomen have displayed their skill. If thou carriest the prize, I will add to it 20 nobles. But if thou losest it, thou shalt be stripped of thy Lincoln green, and scourged out of the lists with bowstrings for a wordy and insolent braggart.
And how have I refused to shoot on such a wager? Said the yeoman.
Your grace's power, supported as it is by so many men-at-arms, may indeed easily strip and scourge me, but cannot compel me to bend or to draw my bow.
If thou refusest my fair proffer, said the prince, the provost of the lists shall cut thy bowstring, break thy bow and arrows, and expel thee from the presence as a faint-hearted craven.
This is no fair chance you put on me, proud prince, said the yeoman, to compel me to peril myself against the best archers of Leicester and Staffordshire, under the penalty of infamy if they should overshoot me. Nevertheless, I will obey your will.
Look to him close, men-at-arms, said Prince John. His heart is sinking. I am jealous lest he attempt to escape the trial. And do you, good fellows, shoot boldly round. A buck and a butt of wine are ready for your refreshment in yonder tent when the prize is won.
A target was placed at the upper end of the southern avenue which led to the lists. The contending archers took their stance in turn at the bottom of the southern access, the distance between that station and the mark allowing full distance for what was called a shot at rovers. The archers, having previously determined by lot their order of precedence, were to shoot each three shafts in succession. The sports were regulated by an officer of inferior rank, termed the provost of the games, for the high rank of the marshals of the lists would have been held degraded had they condescended to superintend the games of the yeomanry. One by one, the archers, stepping forward, delivered their shafts, yeoman-like and bravely. Of 24 arrows shot in succession, 10 were fixed in the target, and the others ranged so near it that, considering the distance of the mark, it was accounted good archery. Of the 10 shafts which hit the target, 2 within the inner ring were shot by Hubert, a forester in the service of Malvoisin, who was accordingly pronounced victorious.
"Now, Locksley," said Prince John to the devoted yeoman with a bitter smile, "wilt thou try conclusions with Hubert, or wilt thou yield up bow, baldric, and quiver to the provost of the sports?"
"Sith it may be no better," said Locksley, "I am content to try my fortune, on condition that when I have shot 2 shafts at yonder mark of Hubert's, he shall be bound to shoot 1 at that which I shall propose."
"That is but fair," answered Prince John, "and it shall not be refused thee. If thou dost beat this braggart, Hubert, I will fill the bugle with silver pennies for thee." "A man can but do his best," answered Hubert, "but my great-grandsire drew a good longbow at Hastings, and I trust not to dishonour his memory."
The former target was now removed, and a fresh one, of the same size, placed in its room. Hubert, who as victor in the first trial of skill had the right to shoot first, took his aim with great deliberation, long measuring the distance with his eye, while he held in his hand his bended bow, with the arrow placed on the string. At length he made a step forward, and raising the bow at the full stretch of his left arm, till the centre or grasping place was nigh level with his face, he drew the bowstring to his ear. The arrow whistled through the air, and lighted within the inner ring of the target, but not exactly in the centre.
"You have not allowed for the wind, Hubert," said his antagonist, bending his bow, "or that had been a better shot."
So saying, and without showing the least anxiety to pause upon his aim, Locksley stepped to the appointed station and shot his arrow as carelessly in appearance as if he had not even looked at the mark. He was speaking almost at the instant that the shaft left the bowstring, yet it alighted in the target 2 inches nearer to the white spot which marked the centre than that of Hubert.
"By the light of heaven," said Prince John to Hubert, "and thou suffer that runagate knave to overcome thee, not worthy of the gallows."
Hubert had but one set speech for all occasions. "An your highness were to hang me," he said, "a man can but do his best. Nevertheless, my grandsire drew a good bow."
"The foul fiend on thy grandsire and all his generation," interrupted John. "Shoot, knave, and shoot thy best, or it shall be the worse for thee."
Thus exhorted, Hubert resumed his place, and not neglecting the caution which he had received from his adversary, he made the necessary allowance for a very light air of wind which had just arisen, and shot so successfully that his arrow alighted in the very centre of the target.
"A Hubert! A Hubert!"
shouted the populace, more interested in a known person than in a stranger.
"In the clout! In the clout! A Hubert forever!"
"Thou canst not mend that shot, Locksley," said the prince with an insulting smile.
"I will notch his shaft for him, however," replied Locksley. And letting fly his arrow with a little more precaution than before, it lighted right upon that of his competitor, which it split to shivers. The people who stood around were so astonished at his wonderful dexterity that they could not even give vent to their surprise in their usual clamour.
"This must be the devil, and no man of flesh and blood," whispered the yeomen to each other. "Such archery was never seen since a bow was first bent in Britain."
"And now," said Locksley,
"I crave your grace's permission to plant such a mark as is used in the North Country, and welcome every brave yeoman who shall try a shot at it to win a smile from the bonny lass he loves best."
He then turned to leave the lists.
"Let your guards attend me," he said, "if you please. I go but to cut a rod from the next willow bush."
Prince John made a signal that some attendant should follow him in case of his escape, but the cry of "Shame! Shame!" which burst from the multitude induced him to alter his ungenerous purpose. Locksley returned almost instantly with a willow wand about 6 feet in length, perfectly straight and rather thicker than a man's thumb. He began to peel this with great composure, observing at the same time that to ask a good woodsman to shoot at a target so broad as had hitherto been used was to put shame upon his skill. "For his own part," he said, "and in the land where he was bred, men would as soon take for their mark King Arthur's round table, which held 60 knights around it. A child of 7 years old," he said, "might hit it with a headless shaft. But," added he, walking deliberately to the other end of the lists and sticking the willow wand upright in the ground, "he that hits that rod at 50 yards... I call him an archer fit to bear both bow and quiver before a king, and it were the stout King Richard himself."
"My grandsire," said Hubert, "drew a good bow at the Battle of Hastings, and never shot at such a mark in his life, and neither will I. If this yeoman can cleave that rod, I give him the bucklers, or rather I yield to the devil that is in his jerkin, and not to any human skill. A man can but do his best, and I will not shoot where I'm sure to miss. I might as well shoot at the edge of our parson's whittle, or at a wheat straw, or at a sunbeam, as at a twinkling white streak which I can hardly see."
"Cowardly dog," said Prince John. "Sir Locksley, do thou shoot, but if thou hittest such a mark, I will say thou art the first man ever did so. However it be, thou shalt not crow over us with a mere show of superior skill."
"I will do my best, as Hubert says," answered Locksley. "No man can do more."
So saying, he again bent his bow, but on the present occasion looked with attention to his weapon and changed the string, which he thought was no longer truly round, having been a little frayed by the two former shots. He then took his aim with some deliberation, and the multitude awaited the event in breathless silence. The archer vindicated their opinion of his skill. His arrow split the willow rod against which it was aimed. A jubilee of acclamations followed, and even Prince John, in admiration of Locksley's skill, lost his dislike to his person.
"These 20 nobles, he said, "which, with the bugle thou hast fairly won, are thine own. We will make them 50, if thou wilt take livery and service with us as a yeoman of our bodyguard, and be near to our person, for never did so strong a hand bend a bow, or so true an eye direct a shaft."
"Pardon me, noble prince," said Locksley, "but I have vowed that if ever I take service,
it should be with your royal brother, King Richard. These 20 nobles I leave to Hubert, who has this day drawn as brave a bow as his grandsire did at Hastings. Had his modesty not refused the trial, he would have hit the wand as well as I."
Hubert shook his head as he received with reluctance the bounty of the stranger, and Locksley, anxious to escape further observation, mixed with the crowd and was seen no more. The victorious archer would not, perhaps, have escaped John's attention so easily had not that prince had other subjects of anxious and more important meditation pressing upon his mind at that instant. He called upon his chamberlain as he gave the signal for retiring from the lists, and commanded him instantly to gallop to Ashby and seek out Isaac the Jew.
"Tell the dog," he said, "to send me before sundown 2,000 crowns. He knows the security, but thou mayst show him this ring for a token. The rest of the money must be paid at York within 6 days. If he neglects, I will have the unbelieving villain's head. Look that thou pass him not on the way, for the circumcised slave was displaying his stolen finery amongst us."
So saying, the prince resumed his horse and returned to Ashby, the whole crowd breaking up and dispersing upon his retreat. Chapter 14. In rough magnificence arrayed, when ancient chivalry displayed the pomp of her heroic games, and crested chiefs and tissued dames assembled at the clarion's call in some proud castle's high-arched hall. Wharton. Prince John held his high festival in the castle of Ashby. This was not the same building of which the stately ruins still interest the traveller, and which was erected at a later period by the Lord Hastings, High Chamberlain of England, one of the first victims of the tyranny of Richard III, and yet better known as one of Shakespeare's characters than by his historical fame. The castle and town of Ashby at this time belonged to Roger de Quincey, Earl of Winchester, who, during the period of our history, was absent in the Holy Land. Prince John, in the meanwhile, occupied his castle and disposed of his domains without scruple, and seeking at present to dazzle men's eyes by his hospitality and magnificence, had given orders for great preparations in order to render the banquet as splendid as possible. The purveyors of the prince, who exercised upon this and other occasions the full authority of royalty, had swept the country of all that could be collected which was esteemed fit for their master's table. Guests also were invited in great numbers, and in the necessity in which he presently found himself of courting popularity, Prince John had extended these to a few distinguished Saxon and Danish families, as well as to the Norman nobility and gentry of the neighbourhood. However despised and degraded on ordinary occasions, the great numbers of the Anglo-Saxons must necessarily render them formidable in the civil commotions which seemed approaching, and it was an obvious point of policy to secure popularity with their leaders. It was accordingly the prince's intention, which he for some time maintained, to treat these unwonted guests with a courtesy to which they had been little accustomed. But although no man with less scruple made his ordinary habits and feelings bend to his interest, it was the misfortune of this prince that his levity and petulance were perpetually breaking out and undoing all that had been gained by his previous dissimulation. Of this fickle temper he gave a memorable example in Ireland, when sent thither by his father, Henry II, with the purpose of buying golden opinions of the inhabitants of that new and important acquisition to the English crown. Upon this occasion, the Irish chieftains contended which should first offer to the young prince their loyal homage and the kiss of peace. But instead of receiving their salutations with courtesy, John and his petulant attendants could not resist the temptation of pulling the long beards of the Irish chieftains, a conduct which, as might have been expected, was highly resented by these insulted dignitaries, and produced fatal consequences to the English domination in Ireland. It is necessary to keep these inconsistencies of John's character in view, that the reader may understand his conduct during the present evening. In execution of the resolution which he had formed during his cooler moments, Prince John received Cedric and Athelstane with distinguished courtesy, and expressed his disappointment, without resentment, when the indisposition of Rowena was alleged by the former as a reason for her not attending upon his gracious summons. Cedric and Athelstane were both dressed in the ancient Saxon garb, which, although not unhandsome in itself, and in the present instance composed of costly materials, was so remote in shape and appearance from that of the other guests that Prince John took great credit to himself with Waldemar Fitzurse for refraining from laughter at a sight which the fashion of the day rendered so ridiculous. Yet, in the eye of sober judgment, the short, close tunic and long mantle of the Saxons was a more graceful, as well as a more convenient dress, than the garb of the Normans, whose undergarment was a long doublet, so loose as to resemble a shirt or wagoner's frock, covered by a cloak of scanty dimensions, neither fit to defend the wearer from cold or from rain, and the only purpose of which seemed to be to display as much fur, embroidery, and jewellery work as the ingenuity of the tailor could contrive to lay upon it. The Emperor Charlemagne seems to have been very sensible of the inconveniences arising from the fashion of this garment.
"In heaven's name," said he, "to what purpose serve these abridged cloaks? If we are in bed, they are no covering. On horseback, they are no protection from the wind and rain. And when seated, they do not protect our legs from the damp or the frost."
Nevertheless, spite of this imperial objurgation, the short cloaks continued in fashion down to the time of which we treat, and particularly among the princes of the House of Anjou. They were, therefore, in universal use among Prince John's courtiers, and the long mantle, which formed the upper garment of the Saxons, was held in proportional derision. The guests were seated at a table which groaned under the quantity of good cheer. The numerous cooks who attended on the prince's progress, having exerted all their art in varying the forms in which the ordinary provisions were served up, had succeeded almost as well as the modern professors of the culinary art in rendering them perfectly unlike their natural appearance. Besides these dishes of domestic origin, there were various delicacies brought from foreign parts, and a quantity of rich pastry, as well as of the simnel bread and wassail cakes, which were only used at the tables of the highest nobility. The banquet was crowned with the richest wines, both foreign and domestic. But, though luxurious, the Norman nobles were not, generally speaking, an intemperate race. While indulging themselves in the pleasures of the table, they aimed at delicacy, but avoided excess, and were apt to object gluttony and drunkenness to the vanquished Saxons as vices peculiar to their inferior strain. Prince John, indeed, and those who courted his pleasure by imitating his foibles, were apt to indulge to excess in the pleasures of the trencher and the goblet, and, indeed, it is well known that his death was occasioned by a surfeit upon peaches and new ale. His conduct, however, was an exception to the general manners of his countrymen. With sly gravity, interrupted only by private signs to each other, the Norman knights and nobles beheld the ruder demeanour of Athelstane and Cedric at a banquet, to the form and fashion of which they were unaccustomed. And while their demeanour was thus the subject of sarcastic observation, the untaught Saxons unwittingly transgressed several of the arbitrary rules established for the regulation of society. Now, it is well known that a man may, with more impunity, be guilty of an actual breach, either of real good breeding or of good morals, than appear ignorant of the most minute point of fashionable etiquette. Thus, Cedric, who dried his hands upon a towel, instead of suffering the moisture to exhale by waving them gracefully in the air, incurred more ridicule than his companion Athelstane when he swallowed to his own single share the whole of a large pasty composed of the most exquisite foreign delicacies, and termed at that time a carum pie. When, however, it was discovered, by a serious cross-examination, that the Thane of Coningsborough, or Franklin, as the Normans termed him, had no idea what he had been devouring, and that he had taken the contents of the carum pie for larks and pigeons, whereas they were in fact beccaficoes and nightingales, his ignorance brought him in for an ample share of the ridicule which would have been more justly bestowed on his gluttony. The long feast had, at length, its end. and while the goblet circulated freely, men talked of the feats of the preceding tournament, of the unknown victor in the archery game, of the Black Knight whose self-denial had induced him to withdraw from the honours he had won, and of the gallant Ivanhoe, who had so dearly bought the honours of the day. The topics were treated with military frankness, and the jest and laugh went round the hall. The brow of Prince John alone was overclouded during these discussions. Some overpowering care seemed agitating his mind, and it was only when he received occasional hints from his attendants that he seemed to take interest in what was passing around him. On such occasions he would start up, quaff off a cup of wine as if to raise his spirits, and then mingle in the conversation by some observation made abruptly or at random.
"We drink this beaker," said he, "to the health of Wilfred of Ivanhoe, champion of this passage of arms, and grieve that his wound renders him absent from our board. Let all fill to the pledge, and especially Cedric of Rotherwood, the worthy father of a son so promising." "No, my lord," replied Cedric, standing up, and placing on the table his untasted cup. "I yield not the name of son to the disobedient youth who at once despises my commands and relinquishes the manners and customs of his fathers."
"'Tis impossible," cried Prince John with well-feigned astonishment, "that so gallant a knight should be an unworthy or disobedient son."
"Yet, my lord," answered Cedric, "so it is with this Wilfred. He left my homely dwelling to mingle with the gay nobility of your brother's court, where he learned to do those tricks of horsemanship which you prize so highly. He left it contrary to my wish and command, and in the days of Alfred that would have been termed disobedience, aye, and a crime severely punishable."
"Alas," replied Prince John, with a deep sigh of affected sympathy,
"since your son was a follower of my unhappy brother, it need not be inquired where or from whom he learned the lesson of filial disobedience."
Thus spoke Prince John, wilfully forgetting that of all the sons of Henry II, though no one was free from the charge, he himself had been most distinguished for rebellion and ingratitude to his father.
"I think," said he, after a moment's pause, "that my brother proposed to confer upon his favourite the rich manor of Ivanhoe."
"He did endow him with it," answered Cedric, "nor is it my least quarrel against my son that he stooped to hold, as a feudal vassal, the very domains which his fathers possessed in free and independent right."
"We shall then have your willing sanction, good Cedric," said Prince John, "to confer this fief upon a person whose dignity will not be diminished by holding land of the British crown. Sir Reginald Front de Boeuf," he said, turning towards that baron, "I trust you will so keep the goodly barony of Ivanhoe that Sir Wilfrid shall not incur his father's farther displeasure by again entering upon that fief."
"By St. Anthony," answered the black-browed giant, "I will consent that your highness shall hold me a Saxon, if either Cedric or Wilfred, or the best that ever bore English blood, shall wrench from me the gift with which your highness has graced me."
"Whoever shall call thee Saxon, Sir Baron," replied Cedric,
offended at a mode of expression by which the Normans frequently expressed their habitual contempt of the English,
"will do thee an honour as great as it is undeserved."
Front de Boeuf would have replied, but Prince John's petulance and levity got the start.
"Assuredly," said he, "my lords, the noble Cedric speaks truth, and his race may claim precedence over us as much in the length of their pedigrees as in the longitude of their cloaks.
They go before us indeed in the field, as deer before dogs," said Malvoisin.
"And with good right may they go before us, forget not," said the prior Aymer, "the superior decency and decorum of their manners."
"Their singular abstemiousness and temperance," said Brassy, forgetting the plan which promised him a Saxon bride.
"Together with the courage and conduct," said Brion de Bois-Guilbert, "by which they distinguish themselves at Hastings and elsewhere."
While, with smooth and smiling cheek, the courtiers, each in turn, followed their prince's example and aimed a shaft of ridicule at Cedric, The face of the Saxon became inflamed with passion, and he glanced his eyes fiercely from one to another, as if the quick succession of so many injuries had prevented his replying to them in turn, or, like a baited bull who, surrounded by his tormentors, is at a loss to choose from among them the immediate object of his revenge. At length he spoke, with a voice half-choked with passion, and, addressing himself to Prince John as the head and front of the offence which he had received,
"Whatever," he said, "have been the follies and vices of our race, a Saxon would have been held niddering,"
the most emphatic term for abject worthlessness,
"who should, in his own hall, and while his own wine cup passed, have treated an unoffending guest as your highness has this day beheld me used. And whatever was the misfortune of our fathers on the field of Hastings, those may at least be silent."
Here he looked at Front de Boeuf and the Templar,
"who have within these few hours once and again lost saddle and stirrup before the lance of a Saxon."
"By my faith, a biting jest," said Prince John. "How like you it, sirs? Our Saxon subjects rise in spirit and courage, become shrewd in wit and bold in bearing in these unsettled times. What say you, my lords? By this good light, I hold it best to take our galleys and return to Normandy in time."
"For fear of the Saxons," said Brassy, laughing, "we should need no weapon but our hunting spears to bring these boars to bay."
Truce with your raillery, sir knights," said Fitzurse. "And it were well," he added, addressing the prince, "that your highness should assure the worthy Cedric there is no insult intended him by jests which must sound but harshly in the ear of a stranger."
"Insult," answered Prince John, resuming his courtesy of demeanour, "I trust it will not be thought that I could mean or permit any to be offered in my presence. Here, I fill my cup to Cedric himself, since he refuses to pledge his son's health."
The cup went round amid the well-dissembled applause of the courtiers, which, however, failed to make the impression on the mind of the Saxon which had been designed. He was not naturally acute of perception, but those too much undervalued his understanding who deemed that this flattering compliment would obliterate his sense of the prior insult. He was silent, however, when the royal pledge again passed round.
"To Sir Athelstane of Coningsborough."
The knight made his obeisance, and showed his sense of the honour by draining a huge goblet in answer to it.
"And now, sirs," said Prince John,
who began to be warmed with the wine which he had drank,
"having done justice to our Saxon guests, we will pray of them some requital to our courtesy. Worthy Thane," he continued, addressing Cedric, "may we pray you to name to us some Norman whose name may least sully your mouth, and to wash down with a goblet of wine all bitterness which the sound may leave behind it?"
Fitzurse arose while Prince John spoke, and, gliding behind the seat of the Saxon, whispered to him not to omit the opportunity of putting an end to unkindness betwixt the two races by naming Prince John. The Saxon replied not to this politic insinuation, but rising up and filling his cup to the brim, he addressed Prince John in these words,
"Your Highness has required that I should name a Norman deserving to be remembered at our banquet. This perchance is a hard task, since it calls on the slave to sing the praises of the master, upon the vanquished, while pressed by all the evils of conquest, to sing the praises of the conqueror. Yet I will name a Norman, the first in arms and in place, the best and the noblest of his race, and the lips that shall refuse to pledge me to his well-earned fame I term false and dishonoured, and will so maintain them with my life. I quaff this goblet to the health of Richard the Lion-hearted."
Prince John, who had expected that his own name would have closed the Saxon's speech, started when that of his injured brother was so unexpectedly introduced. He raised mechanically the wine cup to his lips, then instantly set it down,
to view the demeanour of the company at this unexpected proposal, which many of them felt it as unsafe to oppose as to comply with. Some of them, ancient and experienced courtiers, closely imitated the example of the prince himself, raising the goblet to their lips and again replacing it before them. There were many who, with a more generous feeling, exclaimed, "Long live King Richard, and may he be speedily restored to us!" And some few, among whom were Front de Boeuf and the Templar, in sullen disdain suffered their goblets to stand, untasted, before them. But no man ventured directly to gainsay a pledge filled to the health of the reigning monarch. Having enjoyed his triumph for about a minute, Cedric said to his companion,
"Up, noble Athelstane, we have remained here long enough. Since we have requited the hospitable courtesy of Prince John's banquet, those who wish to know further of our rude Saxon manners must henceforth seek us in the homes of our fathers, since we have seen enough of royal banquets, and enough of Norman courtesy."
So saying, he arose and left the banqueting room, followed by Athelstane and by several other guests, who, partaking of the Saxon lineage, held themselves insulted by the sarcasms of Prince John and his courtiers.
"By the bones of St. Thomas," said Prince John as they retreated, "the Saxon churls have borne off the best of the day and have retreated with triumph."
"Conclamatum est, poculatum est," said Prior Aymer. "We have drunk and we have shouted. It were time we left our wine flagons."
"The monk hath some fair penitent to shrive tonight, that he is in such a hurry to depart," said de Bracy.
"Not so, sir knight," replied the abbot, "but I must move several miles forward this evening upon my homeward journey."
"They are breaking up," said the prince in a whisper to Fitzurse. "Their fears anticipate the event, and this coward prior is the first to shrink from me."
"Fear not, my lord," said Waldemar. "I will show him such reasons as shall induce him to join us to hold our meeting at York."
"Sir prior," he said, "I must speak with you in private before you mount your palfrey."
The other guests were now fast dispersing, with the exception of those immediately attached to Prince John's faction and his retinue.
"This, then, is the result of your advice," said the prince, turning an angry countenance upon Fitzurse, "that I should be bearded at my own board by a drunken Saxon churl, and that, on the mere sound of my brother's name, men should fall off from me as if I had the leprosy."
"Have patience, sir," replied his counsellor. "I might retort your accusation and blame the inconsiderate levity which foiled my design and misled your own better judgment, but this is no time for recrimination. Brassy and I will instantly go among these cowards and convince them they have gone too far to recede."
"It will be in vain," said Prince John,
pacing the apartment with disordered steps and expressing himself with an agitation to which the wine he had drank partly contributed.
"It will be in vain. They have seen the handwriting on the wall. They have marked the paw of the lion in the sand. They have heard his approaching roar shake the wood. Nothing will reanimate their courage."
"Would to God," said Fitzurse de Bracy, "that aught could reanimate his own. His brother's very name is an ague to him. Unhappy are the counsellors of a prince who wants fortitude and perseverance alike in good and in evil."
End of Volume First. Volume 2, Chapter 1. And yet he thinks, ha 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 ha, he thinks I am the tool and servant of his will. Well, let it be. Through all the maze of trouble his plots and base oppression must create, I'll shape myself a way to higher things, and who will say 'tis wrong? Basil, A Tragedy. No spider ever took more pains to repair the shattered meshes of his web
than did Waldemar Fitzurse to reunite and combine the scattered members of Prince John's cabal. Few of these were attached to him from inclination, and none from personal attachment. It was therefore necessary that Fitzurse should open to them new prospects of advantage, and remind them of those which they at present enjoyed. To the young and wild nobles he held out the prospect of unpunished license and uncontrolled revelry, to the ambitious, that of power, and to the covetous, that of increased wealth and extended domains. The leaders of the mercenaries received a donation in gold, an argument the most persuasive to their minds, and without which all others would have proved in vain. Promises were still more liberally distributed than money by this active agent, and, in fine, nothing was left undone that could determine the wavering or animate the disheartened. The return of King Richard he spoke of as an event altogether beyond the reach of probability. Yet when he observed, from the doubtful looks and uncertain answers which he received, that this was the apprehension by which the minds of his accomplices were most haunted, he boldly treated that event, should it really take place, as one which ought not to alter their political calculations. "If Richard returns," said Fitzurse, "he returns to enrich his needy and impoverished crusaders at the expense of those who did not follow him to the Holy Land. He returns to call to a fearful accounting those who, during his absence, have done aught that can be construed offence or encroachment upon either the laws of the land or the privileges of the crown. He returns to avenge upon the orders of the temple and the hospital the preference which they showed to Philip of France during the wars in the Holy Land. He returns, in fine, to punish as a rebel every adherent of his brother Prince John." "Are ye afraid of his power?" continued the artful confidant of that prince. "We acknowledge him a strong and valiant knight, but these are not the days of King Arthur, when a champion could encounter an army. If Richard indeed comes back, it must be alone, unfollowed, unfriended. The bones of his gallant army have whitened the sands of Palestine. The few of his followers who have returned have straggled hither like this Wilfred of Ivanhoe, beggared and broken men. And what talk ye of Richard's right of birth?" he continued, in answer to those who objected scruples on that head. "Is Richard's title of primogeniture more decidedly certain than that of Duke Robert of Normandy, the Conqueror's eldest son? And yet William the Red and Henry, his second and third brothers, were successively preferred to him by the voice of the nation. Robert had every merit which can be pleaded for Richard. He was a bold knight, a good leader, generous to his friends and to the church, and, to crown the whole, a crusader and a conqueror of the Holy Sepulchre, and yet he died a blind and miserable prisoner in the castle of Cardiff, because he opposed himself to the will of the people, who chose not that he should rule over them. It is our right," he said, "to choose from the blood royal the prince who is best qualified to hold the supreme power. That is," said he, correcting himself, "him whose election will best promote the interests of the nobility. In personal qualifications," he said, "it was possible that Prince John might be inferior to his brother Richard, but when it was considered that the latter returned with a sword of vengeance in his hands, while the former held out rewards, immunities, privileges, wealth, and honours, it could not be doubted which was the king whom, in wisdom, the nobility were called on to support." These, and many more arguments, some adapted to the peculiar circumstances of those whom he addressed, had the expected weight with the nobles of Prince John's faction. Most of them consented to attend upon the proposed meeting at York, for the purpose of making general arrangements for placing the crown upon the head of Prince John. It was late at night, when, worn out and exhausted with his various exertions, however gratified with the result, Fitzurse, returning to the castle of Ashby, met with de Bracy, who had exchanged his banqueting garments for a short green kirtle, with hose of the same cloth and colour, a leathern cap or headpiece, a short sword, a horn slung over his shoulder, a long bow in his hand, and a bundle of arrows stuck into his belt. Had Fitzurse met this figure in an outer apartment, he would have passed him without notice, as one of the yeomen of the guard, but finding him in the inner hall, he looked at him with more attention and recognized the Norman knight in the dress of an English yeoman.
"What mummery is this, De Bracy?" said Fitzurse somewhat angrily. "Is this a time for Christmas gambols and quaint maskings, when the fate of our master, Prince John, is on the very verge of decision? Why hast thou not been, like me, among these heartless cravens, whom the very name of King Richard terrifies, as it is said to do the children of the Saracens?"
"I have been minding mine own business," said De Bracy calmly, "as you, Fitzurse."
"I minding mine own business?" echoed Waldemar. "I have been engaged in that of Prince John, our joint patron."
"As if thou hadst any other reason for that, Waldemar," said De Bracy, "than the promotion of thine own individual interest.
Come, Fitzurse, we know each other.
Ambition is thy pursuit, pleasure is mine, and they become our different ages.
Of Prince John thou thinkest as I do, that he is too weak to be a determined monarch, too tyrannical to be an easy monarch, too insolent and presumptuous to be a popular monarch, and too fickle and timid to be long a monarch of any kind. But he is a monarch by whom Fitzurse and Bracy hope to rise and thrive, and therefore you aid him with your policy, and I with the lances of my free companions."
"A hopeful auxiliary," said Fitzurse impatiently, "playing the fool in the very moment of utter necessity. What on earth dost thou purpose by this absurd disguise at a moment so urgent?"
"To get me a wife," answered Bracy coolly, "after the manner of the tribe of Benjamin."
"The tribe of Benjamin?" said Fitzurse. "I comprehend thee not."
"Were thou not in presence yestereven," said De Bracy, "when we heard the prior Aymer tell us a tale in reply to the romance which was sung by the minstrel? He told how, long since in Palestine, a deadly feud arose between the clan of Benjamin and the rest of the Israelitish nation, and how they cut to pieces well nigh all the chivalry of that clan, and how they swore by our Blessed Lady that they would not permit those who remained to marry in their lineage, and how they became grieved for their vow, and sent to consult His Holiness the Pope how they might be absolved from it, and how, by the advice of the Holy Father, the youth of the tribe of Benjamin carried off from a superb tournament all the ladies who were there present, and thus won them wives without the consent either of their brides or their brides' families."
"I have heard the story," said Fitzurse, "though either the prior or thou hast made some singular alterations in date and circumstances."
"I tell thee," said De Bracy, "that I mean to purvey me a wife after the fashion of the tribe of Benjamin, which is as much as to say that in this same equipment I will fall upon that herd of Saxon bullocks who have this night left the castle, and carry off from them the lovely Rowena."
"Art thou mad, De Bracy?" said Fitzurse. "Bethink thee that, though the men be Saxons, they are rich and powerful, and regarded with the more respect by their countrymen, that wealth and honour are but the lot of few of Saxon descent."
"And should belong to none," said De Bracy. "The work of the conquest should be completed."
"This is no time for it, at least," said Fitzurse. "The approaching crisis renders the favour of the multitude indispensable, and Prince John cannot refuse justice to anyone who injures their favourites."
"Let him grant it, if he dare," said De Bracy. "He will soon see the difference betwixt the support of such a lusty lot of spears as mine and that of a heartless mob of Saxon churls. Yet I mean no immediate discovery of myself. Seem I not in this garb as bold a forester as ever blew horn? The blame of the violence shall rest with the outlaws of the Yorkshire forests. I have sure spies on the Saxons' motions. Tonight they sleep in the convent of St. Whittle, or Withold, or whatever they call that churl of a Saxon saint of Burton-on-Trent. Next day's march brings them within our reach, and falconways we swoop on them at once. Presently after,
I will appear in mine own shape, play the courteous knight, rescue the unfortunate and afflicted fair one from the hands of the rude ravishers, conduct her to Front de Boeuf's castle, or to Normandy, if it should be necessary, and produce her not again to her kindred until she be the bride and dame of Maurice de Bracy.
A marvellously sage plan, said Fitzurse, and, as I think, not entirely of thine own device. Come, be frank, de Bracy, who aided thee in the invention, and who is to assist in the execution? For, as I think, thine own band lies as far off as York.
Marry, if thou must needs know, said de Bracy, it was the Templar, Brian de Bois-Guilbert, that shaped out the enterprise which the adventure of the men of Benjamin suggested to me. He is to aid me in the onslaught, and he and his followers will personate the outlaws, from whom my valorous arm is, after changing my garb, to rescue the lady.
By my helidome, said Fitzurse, the plan was worthy of your united wisdom, and thy prudence, de Bracy, is most especially manifested in thy project of leaving the lady in the hands of thy worthy confederate. Thou mayst, I think, succeed in taking her from her Saxon friends, but how thou wilt rescue her afterwards from the clutches of Bois-Guilbert seems considerably more doubtful. He is a falcon, well accustomed to pounce on a partridge, and to hold his prey fast.
He is a Templar, said de Bracy, and cannot therefore rival me in my plan of wedding this heiress, and to attempt aught dishonourable against the intended bride of de Bracy, by heaven, were he a whole chapter of his order in his single person, he dared not do me such an injury.
Then, since naught that I can say, said Fitzurse, will put this folly from thy imagination, for well I know the obstinacy of thy disposition, at least waste as little time as possible. Let not thy folly be lasting as well as untimely.
I tell thee, answered de Bracy, that it will be the work of a few hours, and I shall be at York at the head of my daring and valorous fellows, as ready to support any daring design as thy policy can be to form one. But I hear my comrades assembling, and the steeds stamping and neighing in the outer court. Farewell. I go, like a true knight, to win the smiles of beauty.
Like a true knight, repeated Fitzurse, looking after him. Like a natural fool, I should say, or like a child who will leave the most serious and needful occupation to chase the down of the thistle that drives past him. But it is with such tools that I must work, and for whose advantage? For that of a prince as unwise as he is profligate, and as likely to be an ungrateful master as he has already proved a rebellious son and an unnatural brother. But he too is but one of the tools with whom I labour, and proud as he is, should he presume to separate his interest from mine, this is a secret which he shall soon learn.
The meditations of the statesman were here interrupted by the voice of the prince from an interior apartment, calling out, "Noble Waldemar Fitzurse!" And, with bonnet doffed, the future chancellor, for to such high preferment did the hopes of the wily Norman aspire, hastened to receive the orders of the future sovereign. Chapter 2. Far in a wild, unknown to public view, from youth to age a reverend hermit grew. The moss his bed, the cave his humble cell, his food the fruits, his drink the crystal well. Remote from man, with God he passed his days, prayer all his business, all his pleasure praise. Parnell. The reader cannot have forgotten that the event of the tournament was decided by the exertions of an unknown knight, whom, on account of the passive and indifferent conduct which he had manifested on the former part of the day, the spectators had entitled Le Noir Feignant. This knight had left the field abruptly when the victory was achieved,
and when he was called upon to receive the reward of his valour, he was nowhere to be found. In the meantime, while summoned by heralds and by trumpets, the knight was holding his course northward, avoiding all frequented paths and taking the shortest course through the woodlands. He paused for the night at a small hostelry lying out of the ordinary route, where, however, he obtained from a wandering minstrel news of the event of the tourney. On the next morning, the knight departed early, with the purpose of making a long journey, the condition of his horse, which he had carefully spared during the preceding morning, being such as enabled him to travel far without the necessity of much repose. Yet his purpose was baffled by the devious paths through which he rode, so that when evening closed upon him, he only found himself on the frontiers of the West Riding of Yorkshire. By this